Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Simply Bitcoin IRL. Today, I have a very special guest. I've been looking forward to this for quite a while because Troy Cross, when he came on the show, he have to speak with Matthew. So I've been looking forward to this. Before we start our conversation, I want to give a shout out to the awesome Bitcoin company that makes this show possible, SwanBitcoin.com. Best place to buy Bitcoin, built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. They incentivize self-custody and they also incentivize dollar cost averaging. If you haven't already done so, visit SwanBitcoin.com today. Anyways, I want to welcome Matthew on stage. Matthew, happy to have you, man. Been really looking forward to this conversation. We've been crossing paths quite a while, just all the conferences, all the events. So how you doing this fine Tuesday night?
I'm doing well. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome. So I'm going to rip the Band-Aid right from the rip, guys. I've been doing this. I did this with Jeff Booth about a week ago. I'm going to do it with Matt. Matt, what did you think of the Elizabeth Warren bill that she introduced? It was bipartisan. She introduced it with Senator Marshall. I texted David from Bitcoin Policy Institute. I texted him with our media, like, what's going on here? And basically the argument that he was making to me is like, Nico, they're trying to move the Overton window. But at least they're showing us their cards. Like, at least they're showing us exactly what it is they want to do. And for anyone that doesn't know, the Elizabeth Warren bill that she introduced with Senator Marshall would basically force software developers in the United States to register with the state in order to contribute code to Bitcoin. Very scary stuff. Matthew, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes. So first sort of bottom line up front is it's not going to become law. So just in terms of like framing both kind of practically speaking, when someone introduces a bill versus kind of what does this mean in terms of the broader kind of movement in terms of like the political Overton window and kind of, you know, elevation of potential risks to Bitcoin, et cetera. Like the basic bottom line assessment is it's mostly done as like a signaling bill, right? This is what happens when you get to the end of a particular congressional term. And Warren has a really good sort of SOP for putting out these types of messaging bills, getting a lot of media play. She's really good at kind of drawing attention. And that helps, you know, inside the Senate to, you know, help her cajole folks maybe that don't have as strong feelings about the subject to kind of come closer to her. So this is all about political maneuvering, political influence inside the Senate, and posturing. So yeah, that's like the bottom line assessment. I think David is correct that it's it doesn't, you know, present like a material risk to you know, the current state of Bitcoin and U.S. Sort of legal frameworks. But it does, you know, bespeak, right? Those folks inside the Senate that have those views are now bringing forth very explicit legislative proposals that put a lot of teeth behind kind of their latent animus to Bitcoin.
Yeah, and so in a way, right, I'll be honest with you, Matt. Like to the regular show, this is more the podcast, so it's more like an interview, mm-hmm. but the regular show that we do on a daily basis, what we're known for, Simply Bitcoin Live, we are slaves to the news cycle. We have mm-hmm. to stay on top of what's going mm-hmm. on just to do a good job, right? Because that's what we do, right? And slowly what I've seen happening is I've done this for 2 years now. This slow, ominous cloud is just coming ever so slowly. And I feel like the Elizabeth Warren bill was just another escalation of that. But more importantly, mm-hmm. It just confirmed to me that we are kind of heading into this territory. And what do I mean by that? Right. So the U.S. government, specifically the U.S. Treasury Office of Foreign Asset Control, gets a tremendous amount of power by controlling the money flows. Right. The U.S. sanction policy. Bitcoin is open monetary network. Right. And we're already seeing moves by Russia and Iran. Right. To implement Bitcoin into their financial system in a way to circumvent a lot of these U.S. sanctions. So you kind of see where I'm going with this, right? I see an inevitable clash between U.S. sanction policy and just their whole strategy and Bitcoin in itself, right? I don't think, in my opinion, I think it's inevitable. And I've had the privilege to speak with Jason Brett, and I've had the privilege to speak with Troy as well. It's the same question I asked them. I'm like, hey guys, what's going on here? And basically what they were telling me is regulators are okay with this, okay with Bitcoin, but they want to maintain control over the monetary policy. They want to be able to maintain control over money. Bitcoin doesn't flex there. It doesn't bend, right? It's not a question. It's Bitcoin is, and that's how it is. What are your questions on, like, what are your thoughts on all this?
Yes. So putting like on my like analyst hat, right, before kind of bringing in like personal views, right, I try to like just assess mm-hmm. the situation. And like two key dimensions, right, to your first observation about this darkening cloud moving in, kind of what's behind that. I think it's like multi-causal, but I think one of the most like proximate causes is just Bitcoin's success over the past 2 to 3 years, right? In general, right, when it's not that big of a deal in terms of total market cap, in terms of total users of the network, and in terms of penetration of mining, and just as a policy topic, like the government is like an iceberg or is like a cruise ship, right? It doesn't turn that quickly, but then once it starts turning, it's hard for it to pivot, right? So it took a while for the government to kind of react to Bitcoin's pretty dramatic success, right, post March 2020, and that, you know, that those sort of echoes throughout the national security bureaucracy, you know, still are kind of cascading through. So I think it's a lot in the governments is just playing catch up initially, but then like anything else with the government, right, they always take what they already have as their latent views as to inform any reaction to like a change in the external environment. And in the government, most of the folks inside, say, the Treasury Department or folks inside the FBI, you know, their go-to experts on crypto are folks that got started working this issue back, you know, in its early days when it was mostly focused from a law enforcement perspective on Silk Road and dark web markets, and then sort of evolved into sort of the ransomware sort of criminal groups. So that's where their experience comes from entirely, right? So their narrow remit inside law enforcement is basically just to stop bad guys. And they're viewing like, okay, what sorts of tools are bad guys using? We're going to go after those tools. And those are the folks inside the bureaucracy that have the most sort of years under their belt. So whenever, you know, the word comes down from on high, the National Security Council, the White House, that there needs to be more official action, a task force needs to be created, we need to create a national cryptocurrency enforcement team, like who gets brought onto those task force, who gets brought onto those teams? It's the folks that have those years of experience, but their disposition is likely going to be more sort of like ill-disposed towards Bitcoin because of their past experience with it. But also like strategically, so that's like the narrow kind of bureaucratic explanation of like why I think you're seeing some of the moves happen is, you know, the government is one, it works on a lag, and two, the people that get like physically assigned to those positions of responsibility are the folks that have, you know, the more narrow kind of law enforcement experience associated with Bitcoin, which is, you know, disposes them towards it negatively. Strategically, right, to your question about looking forward, and this inevitable clash, right, or posited potential inevitable clash between like core interests, right, the core interests of the U.S. government, you know, you can imagine, like, I think they've even put this down.
Wait, hold on. You totally buried the lead, Matthew.
Yeah,
what are the core interests of the U.S. government?
Well, there's a lot of them, but I think the three
as it relates to Bitcoin.
Yeah, so the three is control of the monetary policy. The second is monetary, you know, like financial stability. And the third would be, you know, using the dollar system as a tool of geoeconomic coercion, right? So sanctions, right? So essentially monetary policy, having, you know, a stable financial system and being able to use our control over the sort of global dollar system to sanction, you know, our adversaries or folks that that we want to compel. So that's like, those are the tools that's like built into the DNA of sort of national security strategy and all the instruments of national power that the bureaucracy isn't just going to give up, and certainly is going to take any potential challenge as a challenge that they need to counter or to accommodate as long as it kind of comes into the regulatory perimeter in a way that doesn't defeat these core national interests. I think you're muted.
Yeah, before thanks, Opti. Before, see, this is why Opti's awesome. So before I interrupted you, right, you were about to embark on we talked about the ominous cloud, but the inevitable clash.
Yes. So this is where I'm not a social determinist, right, or political determinist. Like, these are, the government is made of people, right? And I look at it through a number of dimensions in terms of who actually are in these positions, right? And like any government, right, they bring their own experiences to bear. And policy usually changes as a function of like people, right? People are in these positions. GS-15 is like the sort of senior of the civil service. And then senior executive service is sort of the more political executive layer that really are like the main kind of cadre of policy makers inside these brackets. So like inside OFAC, right? The people that sort of are at the top of the leadership hierarchy of OFAC, the GS-15s and the SCSs. And it's like a handful of people that really, when it comes down to like making policy, right? When you know, the president says like, we need to stop these bad guys, the president doesn't say like, hey, go after Bitcoin, right? That gets translated down through the bureaucracy. And then someone says, well, how do we effectively implement this top level guidance? Well, I've got my authorities, I've got my tools, I'm going to, implement it in XYZ way. And if they're negative against Bitcoin, then that's going to be part of the course of action that they propose that they could approve. But, I think this is where I sort of see this as not necessarily like an inevitable clash, because I think there are reasons to think that U.S. government could come to view Bitcoin's potentially its core national security interests, but it's going to require accommodation, right? It's going to require an evolution. And this is not going to be necessarily a smooth linear process, but like how I see just like the U.S. government is not just like abstract monolith of like interests. It's people that run bureaucracies, and people have different views, and those views can change as different people come into those organizations, as well as when they assess that external environment, right? It's not necessarily it's part of my thesis basically that the core instruments that have sustained U.S. national security for the past 50 years, like the sort of geoeconomic instruments, you could say the dollar system, et cetera, which we have sort of become very used to as like just a go-to tool in the toolkit whenever we want to like, punish somebody. They're starting to, like, we sort of reached the point where they have any sort of marginal benefit, and potentially reaching a point where their use has more marginal cost. And that sort of is a declining curve that means that we may have a strategic challenge on our hands. We have to look for more like non-traditional approaches to how we, get through this decade of intense geopolitical competition, monetary instability. And I think to assume that, say, the U.S. Treasury security is going to be the dominant global reserve asset for the next 20, 30 years is not necessarily a safe assumption. And so everything else flows, right, in terms of how we think about structuring national security apparatus, in terms of enforcing the hegemonic status of the U.S. Treasury security. These are the things where fundamentally I think the future monetary order is ultimately downstream of the future geopolitical order. So I don't think we can really project too far into the future and make some strong claims about this inevitable clash between a certain current construct of monetary rules and bureaucratic enforcement mechanisms into that future, when there could be a lot that changes in the next 10 or 20 years. It's like the bottom line to this is just like, it's more about a matter of time. It's a matter of not forcing an issue, sooner rather than later, right? Like for me, right, like the risk is really that you see Bitcoin disruptively monetized in a short period of time, where it would present like an acute challenge to the existing national security structure, right? Where they're like, we haven't had time to adapt to this. We haven't had time to formulate a coherent national strategy over a long period of time where we can see how we could calibrate ourselves in a way that maybe we can stand to benefit from it relative to our adversaries. And yes, this will be like a very complicated, multidimensional, like national readjustment over many, many years. But that's a feasible path you could imagine, as long as new people come into those organizations that have a slightly different mindset. And they have to adapt to changing external circumstances. But if this happens really quickly, right, then that sort of benign thesis would be less likely, right? Then existing power structures always do it when they're challenged, right? They're usually not disposed very kindly, right? Their first order of business is just to contain the problem, do whatever we need to do to keep things stable, and that's usually where you can get some of those risky scenarios.
Yeah. So I agree. I think the transition definitely needs to be gradual. Can't be, all at once. 100% agree, because then you risk that knee-jerk reaction, right? However, there is a lot of things that a lot of these, you know, to put it nicely and cordially, there's a lot of power that a lot of these bureaucracies have accumulated that in a Bitcoin world, in a hyper Bitcoinized world that I think, you know, all Bitcoiners are, you know, talking about and dreaming of, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of those are going to be greatly reduced. And is that a pill that they don't have a choice, but it's something that they're going to have to swallow. What's your perception on that? Because I think, to be honest with you, I think Elizabeth Warren, she's a very smart lady. She knows exactly what she's doing. Senator Marshall, maybe he got caught up on it, but I have a feeling that Senator Elizabeth Warren knows what's going on. And I think she knows what's going on because of the thing that I just described to you, right? A lot, specifically the U.S. government, right? They benefit tremendously from having this privilege of being able to create money for free that everybody else has to work for. Bitcoin is a threat to that, right? Bitcoin is a threat to that system. It allows individuals to opt out, right? So what's your response to that? Because it's like, I totally agree. Like if the transition is slowly, right? You know, Corey Clipson wrote The Race to Avoid the War, right? You could hope for a greater amount of adoption. Therefore, Bitcoin becomes such a well politically entrenched issue that it's like gun legislation, mm-hmm. like good luck, right? Mm-hmm. Is that what you're referring to, right? Is it yeah. not? So, yeah, go ahead.
No, I think, again, I don't have a crystal ball, right? And I think probabilistically, right? So I don't necessarily think anything is inevitable. I think in terms of degrees of likelihood and things can happen that would, you know, shift the balance of likelihood in right? I guess where I would start is, when I question the premise, which is that Bitcoin would like inevitably just like take over, right? In terms of the dominant governing political institution, right? I think of Bitcoin as an institution, right? More than even just a money, right? We think of money as a product of a certain institutional arrangement, right? Human society, human political organization, right? Are nested institutions, right? And what we currently exist in as a political structure is a certain type of institutional framework that really evolved out of World War II, right? You think of how the national security and really just all the federal government bureaucracies are currently constituted. It was really how do we fight and win World War II and create these vertically integrated, centrally managed, you know, large bureaucratic control structures that can, you know, tax and spend large amounts of resources in order to, you know, essentially manage that sort of socioeconomic system. Technology changes, institutions change. And I think like my broader thesis over like longer historical timescales is that there is a sort of a typical rise and fall in terms of institutional birth, institutional like optimization and institutional decay. And you see this throughout history, right? You see lots of political cultures, institutions that are well adapted to a certain domestic political and economic environment, technological environment, cultural environment, and an external geopolitical environment that are usually the ones that are best suited for those conditions win, right? Like, and that's what the United States institutional sort of power structure was post-World War II. I think my broader thesis is like these institutional structures are kind of reaching a point of difficulty, right? We're seeing them strain to adapt to all sorts of things, not just Bitcoin, but just, you know, cultural trends, wealth inequality, rapid pace of technology change, demographic issues, like just, you know, a whole slew of things you could put in this bucket that would be a slightly different conversation. But I think you can't just like look at it as just Bitcoin as like one variable, right? That's like changing and then everything else has to change against Bitcoin. Like Bitcoin is this new variable that's coming into this very complicated sociopolitical system that is already going to be challenging our existing political institutions, right? And so I don't know exactly that you can chart out like this like nice clean line into the future and say like Bitcoin is the determining variable for how the future political system evolves. Like I think it is a new variable that is going to potentially be a very important variable over, you know, the next 5 or 10 years. But exactly how this new dynamic will sort of play out in terms of the relationship of, you know, what we currently call the state, which is a set of institutions, like the Fed is an institution, the Treasury Department is an institution, the legal framework that defines how our current monetary arrangement works, the sort of implicit norms about a relationship between sort of federalist, the authorities of the federal government versus state governments. Like these things have always evolved and they've always been politically tested and they've always really been driven by sort of endogenous political dynamics, right? Like new social groups get power, new cultural trends take root and dramatically change kind of what like the median voter thinks is acceptable. And politicians react to the median voters' preferences ultimately. And so this is where I don't think it's as deterministic as maybe, like you've laid out, that there's this inevitable clash between this very rigid state system and this like one single new variable that's going to come in and potentially upset the apple cart. Like that is a nice clean like story, but like, in reality it's very messy. And I think like there are scenarios where like you get say this rapid takeoff of Bitcoin, it goes to $500,000 in 2 years, and then it would become like the most important issue, right? It would be thing it would ever, you know, the government would have to react to it and probably not react to it very benignly, right? And that would get you that scenario where there is this inevitable clash. But yeah, I don't know if that specific scenario is the one that we're going to see. I think there's other ways it could play out. I guess that's like more like an academic discussion, right? Because this is where I step back and I put like my more philosophical hat on. Institutions, Bitcoin as a non-function that's growing and is potentially going to undermine some subset of our existence. But our institutions have always evolved. And so there's no, I guess, like a priori reason for me to think that Bitcoin emerging as a new form of institution that's premised on, you know, providing this sort of self-sovereign monetary asset and a peer-to-peer, you know, essentially persistent transmission system, you know, can't be accommodated under some reconfiguration of an institutional framework that we would still call something like a state, right? Like these things are not binaries. These things exist on a spectrum. And we've seen radical transformations of those institutional state structures, you know, every few decades. And I don't expect that, you know, trend to stop. Again, yeah. That was maybe a little abstract.
It totally wasn't, because you basically were talking. Okay. So to break it down, right. Yeah. Is if there is rapid adoption, right, it might unhinge a lot of people and threaten the existing power structure. But if it's a more gradual adoption, right, and with gradual adoption, you could assume that means more adoption of the populace. More adoption of the populace, politicians are going to have to adapt to that. And you're making the case, Matthew, that the U.S. government specifically, not the U.S. government, but the administrative state, right? The a lot of people call it the deep state. You know, put that aside. I'm not going to talk about that. But the bureaucracy that's there, regardless of who gets elected into power, you don't foresee that. And I want to emphasize that, right? They benefit tremendously from deficit spending, from being able to print money to, right? How much, the $1.7 trillion omnibus bill, right? We can't afford that through tax revenue alone. That has to be paid for by deficit spending. And you can make the case that Bitcoin is a threat to that. That doesn't, you know, because regardless of the slow, gradual transition, the U.S. government is one of the largest employers in the world. Last time I checked, 10 million people employed in the U.S. alone. Mm-hmm. How are they going to be able to pay for those jobs? That's a huge amount of people, you know? Or are you making the case that the deficit spending is going to be able to continue under a Bitcoin standard?
Well, there's a lot packed in there. I'd say Bitcoin never existed, right? The U.S. government in 20 years, maybe 10 years, is going to have a lot of trouble paying for itself, right? That's kind of like maybe the reason why Bitcoin is potentially going to be successful the next years is because we're going to have to issue so much debt and we're going to have trouble finding sort of natural buyers of that debt. And so the Fed is going to eventually have to sort of be the increasing marginal buyer of that debt. And that's sort of how typical debt monetizations and, you know, currency devaluations take place, right? When you have this long-term debt cycle that is associated with political decay. So like that would be the case regardless of Bitcoin, right? And now that, you know, maybe the political narrative would be this is being caused by Bitcoin, because Bitcoin would be like the sort of the most sensitive measure of that sort of monetary political instability. And they would like want to attack Bitcoin because it's sort of like a symptom of this endogenous, sort of decay. But like, I don't think Bitcoin is going to be the cause, or like just analytically, like that would be the trouble regardless. And the government was, you know, eventually going to run into this problem, right? We're going to have to find a way to politically accommodate a lot of different obligations that we can't necessarily meet, right? Like between entitlement spending, defense spending, a whole bunch of other objectives that are going to run into the fact that the global monetary arrangement isn't necessarily going to accommodate our deficit issuance, right? That was the crux of our hegemonic status in the past 50 years, is that we could print the money, but like that that was not just like a matter of political will, right? Or it was a matter of a geoeconomic arrangement where like we ran deficits, we absorbed surpluses from, you know, like OPEC basically, and then China. And we had this nice treasury sort of US dollar sale recycling system built out. That's what, you know, enabled the growth of you know, kind of a lot of these sort of other obligations that now maybe we can't support. So you're asking like, okay, well then what's the political reaction, right? Like the narrow interests of say the folks that work in the government is going to be like, keep their job. Well, obviously, right? But like we've seen this happen before, right? Where like, you know, this is like a political question, right? People are going to vote, you know, ultimately, right, to their interests. And like you could change the Congress and the Congress can say, yeah, we're not going to finance those deficits anymore. Like that would just like be like a very specific kind of, you know, like political action. And that's, you've seen that throughout history. And ultimately, like, you know, this government can't self-finance. It needs the Congress to, you know, pass those budgets. but you're like, so I decompose this broader question of like U.S. government needs the money printer into, well, what are those specific, you know, social power centers, right? There's very different sort of structures, whether it's like Wall Street as like one nucleus of like institutional elites that have a certain relationship to the current monetary and political dynamic. There's the folks that are elected to Congress. There's, you know, broader business leaders. There's, you know, an active and an intelligent and motivated citizenry that can engage in the political system and express themselves. Like these are not like, it's like there's one group that runs the show, right? Like, even though it's nice sometimes we like to tell ourselves that is because it's a clean story. It's a lot of messy, you know, political actors that have their own narrow self-interests that, yes, like the 50-year history of this kind of dollar treasury recycling system worked really well for certain sectors of our political and social system, right? Especially those sectors that could capture those capital flows coming in from, you know, overseas surplus nations. So the Russian oligarchs going and buying up London property, the Middle Eastern princes, you know, recycling a lot of their extra cash into JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs products and real estate investment products and buying up equity in social media companies and Chinese surpluses coming in and buying up land and other assets. Like this was the dynamic where a lot of these external dollar surpluses were recycled in the United States, and industries that stood to sort of capture those flows don't want to see those flows broken, right? Case in point, like Ray Dalio, right? Ray Dalio, who I think has a good analytic assessment of these long-term dynamics, but his firm, which he's recently stepped back from, Bridgewater, you know, they manage, you know, billions of dollars for the Chinese state central bank and associated institutions. So like they are like a core example of some existing actor that would not want the system to change in terms of these dollar flows. I don't think Bitcoin is going to be the thing that breaks those flows. Like those flows are sort of inherently unstable, right? And they reach a point where they can't be sustained because they cause other failures, right? For example, like this system has resulted in periodic financial crises that have ballooned public debts. This system has resulted in massive social pathologies, right? Where our manufacturing base gets eroded and, you know, the fire sector, finance, insurance, real estate stands to gain. Those subsets of the population, the reason why Jamie Dimon hates Bitcoin, right? I have a thesis, right? Which is that there's other actors that have a say in the system. I think there are a lot of them that could be growing in importance and could counterbalance some of those existing actors that wouldn't want the system to change. But, you know, one important actor is the like accumulated median voter who like feels the system isn't working for them and might be open to, you know, evolutionary exploration of alternatives. And wouldn't be behind like a radical measure that would sort of infringe on what we think is, you know, inherent American, you know, civil rights, civil liberties. An important new stakeholder that I think could become, you know, something that's like at least Bitcoin neutral is going to be the Defense Department and intelligence apparatus, which I think has now recognized that this financial system for the past 50 years, which we really sort of like supercharged U.S. A hegemony, is causing all sorts of second order feedback loops that are now maybe like creating more costs and potentially putting us at an acute national security disadvantage. For example, China weaponizing their dollar surpluses as part of the Belt and Road Initiative to exert geoeconomic influence throughout Eurasia and Africa and even South America and Europe. okay, this is a problem. They're using dollars and the dollar system against us, right? And you know, another related pathology that is creating an acute national security vulnerability is the U.S. Treasury security itself, which is, you know, the foundational dollar funding collateral in the offshore dollar system. And we need that system to become stable, because whenever there's a run in the offshore dollar system, Treasury securities get fire sold. And like we saw in the repo crisis, well, like we saw in particular in March 2020, there's essentially a run on the offshore dollars and Treasury security market goes no bid. And the Fed has to do trillions of dollars of QE. And the Defense Department's waking up to this and realizing this is an acute geostrategic vulnerability to us, and that we can't expect the system to just inevitably endure and be a source of national power as opposed to a source of national weakness. And so there is, I think, just to like zoom out then, like these are different interest groups, different sort of status quo institutional power centers that could react differently to Bitcoin's marginal success. I agree with you. There's certain incumbent elites that would be completely against Bitcoin succeeding because it would take away the punch bowl that they've been, dipping into for the past several decades. But I think, I don't think those stakeholders necessarily are the only people that have a say. That's like one of my, interesting observations is getting these folks in the security apparatus to realize that maybe Jamie Dimon and Ray Dalio don't have U.S. national interests at heart. Ultimately, maybe they have, Bridgewater and J.P. Morgan's national, personal interests at heart, and maybe the system that they've leveraged to their personal benefit is starting to create, acute vulnerabilities for us. And so that creates a door, that creates an opening, right? At least doesn't mean they're all on Bitcoin's side per se, but it means that I'd say like the forces of opposition aren't as monolithic as you might assume.
This is fascinating. I'm really enjoying this. Shout out, Troy. You got it spot on, my friend. So you said something really, really, at least it's interesting. I thought it was really interesting, Matt. This idea that it's not a monolith, right? The U.S. government, it's a bunch of special, I hate saying that, but a bunch of interested people, very powerful, group of people from different sectors, and that kind of makes up the power structure. Do you believe that Bitcoin's incentives are going to be great enough to win over enough of the populace to at least drill up that political willpower, right? What are your thoughts on that?
That's like a predictive future question, and I'm not good at predicting the future questions. But
well, this is more because Matt, this is what I think about all the time, right? It's kind of like the game theory of it, right?
Yeah. I like to model it out, right? And I could see, So again, these are very very complex systems, right? Where finding the nice clean story is a nice clean story, but reality is messy, and often stuff happens, right? Like COVID happens, the Ukraine war happens, right? Like lots of stuff that we don't know is going to happen in 2023 and 2024 and 2025 that could create lots of exogenous shocks, that could affect Bitcoin either extremely negatively, extremely positively, right? And that affects ultimately your question of like, what does the adoption curve look like, right? Because if everything is downstream, like to Corey's point, like is downstream of the adoption curve, well then like everything drills down to the question of, well then what are the key factors that will change the adoption curve over what time horizon? And I break that down in like two buckets, right? What can happen or what is likely to happen versus like what should happen? To Bitcoin itself, like the Bitcoin network, the Bitcoin community, the Bitcoin narrative structure, these types of discussions, like the things that you might call like within the Bitcoin, nascent institution, right? What can the Bitcoin nascent institution do to maximize, the rate of change of that adoption curve? That's like one path of analysis and discussion. What's an effective communication strategy? What's an effective narrative framework? What's an effective technical development strategy for, Stratum V2 versus Taro versus all these, potential BIPs, Lightning Network development. That's like one whole strand of discussion that like ultimately helps form a view of how fast you think that adoption curve goes, getting institutions to, sell it in your 401k, all that stuff, right? That's like the subject of a lot of Bitcoin conversation. And there's like a whole nother set of discussions, which is like, what could happen in the rest of the world, right? What could happen with like things like the COVID, shock, right? Which, you know, I think everyone recognizes, like, that was a critical inflection point for Bitcoin's adoption to a certain extent, because it caused such a dramatic reaction, both politically, socially, economically, in terms of the monetary expansion, that like Bitcoin, you know, saw like, you know, whatever, 20x from the March lows. And so that's how I would put it into those two key buckets. And so then any one of those, you could have a separate conversation about what do we think is likely to happen that's like the most promising development, say with like Fediments and other custody solutions that could help make, you know, the hurdle for self-custody a little bit lower. And that makes the psychological aversion to Bitcoin for the median, you know, adoptee lower, and that increases its total, you know, addressable user base more quickly. What could be another exogenous, say, monetary shock, geopolitical shock, political shock domestically, that could cause people to wake up to the value proposition of Bitcoin, right? Like Canadian truckers, or at the sovereign level, Russian sanctions, or some other, you know, monetary breakdown, like another repo market breakdown, or some instability in the treasury security market, some, you know, flip back to quantitative easing. Like all of these, like ultimately that's where the question comes down to for me, right? Is like, if everything comes down to Bitcoin adopting faster, in terms of like, not number go up in terms of price, but number go up in terms of, you know, like people that hold some material amount of their net worth in Bitcoin, and understand it and understand how to self-custody it, that's the number that you would want to go up. And you want to see, okay, well, that's the bottom line, right? Because if that number reaches some critical threshold, right, we don't know exactly what it is, domestically at least, then I think you could argue that these tail risk scenarios of, you know, a government, you know, crackdown, you could have a whole separate discussion how that would happen, what they would try to do, and who's the they that would be doing it. Like, you know, that's what reduces that pushes those tails further out to the tails. Doesn't mean they're gone, but it just means, you know, we're thinking in terms of probabilities, and, you know, certain things pull that type of scenario closer, certain things push it away. And certainly growing adoption and, you know, making it seem like this is a good thing for America, and that's an easy thing for people to use, that's how you see it succeed.
Yeah, and that's the, you know, that's the, I call it narrative trench warfare, right? That's the battle, right, is winning over the hearts and minds to at least have enough of a grassroots movement here in the U.S. But there's been a pattern that I've noticed, Matthew, which is in the developed world, Alex Gladstein calls it financial privilege, right? Mm-hmm. The bread and circuses are strong, so to speak. What do I mean by that? Very developed financial rails, and the inflation is ever so slight that people don't really notice. The totally other conversation in the developed world, I'm sorry, in the developing world, mm-hmm. where it's not a matter of, oh, speculative, you know, Bitcoin fixes this. It's a matter of, how do I put food on the table, right? So it's mm-hmm. a totally different incentive mm-hmm. structure. In my opinion, the developing world incentive structure is much stronger. And I brought this up to Jeff Booth last week, and his response was fascinating. He said, people that are farther away from the benefits of the monopoly are going to be the first ones to adopt an alternative. And I thought that was really, really fascinating. So the question that I have for you, Matt, is, and this is a very strong answer to what he said, right? The question I have for you, Matt, is, are the do people have enough of an incentive in the West to adopt something like Bitcoin without something breaking? Of course, something breaks, you know, inflation mm-hmm. stays where it's at, or, you know, something catastrophic happens, then it's like, okay, people are like going to seek an alternative. But how things are right now, the reality is that most of my friends, most of my old friends, really, because they're not friends with me anymore, because all I do is talk about Bitcoin. Is that enough of an incentive? Because the educational thing is very, like, it's a very uphill battle. It's what I do every single day, is trying to orange pill people. But it's extremely difficult. The reality is that most people just, they don't care, right? If you speak to someone in Venezuela, you speak to someone in Argentina, they're like, I love this thing. This thing is awesome. Where can I sign up? Someone in the West, it's like, uses too much energy, right? I've heard that many times.
Yeah, no, I mean, people really only use a new thing when they need it or they think it's cool, right? And so there's like different arguments, right? Like, or they think it's going to make them rich, right? Those are the three things, right? So it's like, use it because you need it, use it because it's cool, it's like a social signifier, or you because you think it's going to make you rich. And so like in the developing world, right, in terms of like, we're looking at just like total numbers of people, I think it's the need to use it that's the most sort of driving factor that, to your point, right, and Alex Gladstein's, you know, excellent writings have sort of articulated that this is a tool that's being used to solve real world problems by people who like need this particular type of tool. And okay, great. And yes, like that drive, that rationale and that use case for that that subset of adoption is probably not going to be all that applicable to the typical, you know, rich, fat, you know, sort of Westerner who's got Visa and, you know, MasterCard. I mean, I think there's still an argument that there's some segments of the population that, you know, still find, you know, they're not all that rich. They don't all that have access to banks, or, you know, financial privacy is a concern for them. They're worried about, you know, necessarily like a spouse, you know, that might be, you know, monitoring everything they do, and they want to, you know, have their own, you know, like a better life or something like this. This is like, there's reasons I think people in the West would still have that kind of need to use justification. But I agree, like the principal motivation behind, I think, most people in the West is because they think it's cool, or they think it's going to make them rich. And how, what's that end, right, for those people? I think the reason why this kind of balances out is that, you know, for the folks in the West, they don't have to need it to say put like 2% into it, right? And if you have, it just makes it such an easy thing to do. And just like no one looks at their stock portfolio, really. They just say, oh, give me the ETFs for whatever. And if that ETF has a 2% allocation to Bitcoin, then that's 2% allocation to Bitcoin, right? Now, that's not necessarily Bitcoin. That's, you know, a Bitcoin IOU and some ETF product. But it's, you know, there's so much wealth in the United States that, like, in terms of net effect on, like, the market cap, that would probably be a lot more than, you know, someone in Lebanon that's, like, has a collapsing banking system is taking, you know, all of their net worth, which might be, you know, $1,000 equivalent, and putting into Bitcoin just so they can like at least get it out of this banking system and protect it from, you know, an extractive, oppressive elite, sort of, you know, like, you know, dysfunctional state. So yeah, these are different arguments, but I agree. Like this is where, I don't know, it's more of like a choose your own adventure, right? Like these are, there's no good or bad. This is just the way I think it's going to play out.
Yeah. So you said something really interesting, right? Which is, you know, if a big percentage of the population put 2% of their wealth in Bitcoin, but that only works if a large portion of that number is taking Bitcoin into self-custody. Like that's the revolution, is taking wealth back into your possession. In the process, you're taking it out of the system. That's what's actually going to effectuate change. If a lot of people are just treating Bitcoin like Robin Hood, it's like, oh, whatever, nothing changes, right? Catlin Long has been screaming from the skies like rehypothecation. And we just saw it. We saw a small fraction of what the consequences of that. And the reason I'm saying small is because I suspect that this is what's happening right now. Could you imagine the FTX equivalent in 5 years? It's going to be Mt. Gox, right? Everyone's like, that was terrible. Fast forward, FTX. So what are your thoughts on that? Like, you mentioned Fediments earlier, right? I call this the self-custody problem. People get mad at me on Twitter when I say that because they're like, there is no self-custody problem. And I'm like, dude, you understand. We're hardcore Bitcoiners. We could use a cold card with our eyes closed. But the fact is, that you introduced self-custody to someone with a cold card first, they're going to throw the cold card. They'll be like, you're a crazy person, right? So,
yeah, you put your finger on it, right? And, you know, I don't have a good answer for this because I think this is a challenge, right? This is a challenge for user interface. It's a challenge for, like, technical development, right? Like, I forget his name. I'm blanking on it, but he just put out a new proposal for, like, a certain type of vault structure, right, which you can kind of, like, safely time lock. I didn't read all the details, but like this is meant to solve some of this challenge of where you don't want to have all everything in a single SIG that like you've got, you know, tucked away somewhere. This is, you know, like ultimately this is going to be about technology development, right? Like, you know, whether it's BIPs or whether it's just, you know, something that can interact, you know, in some sort of more of a hybrid fashion that, you know, provides some more hybrid applications and allows people to sort of, you know, dip their toe in the water. And again, this is not going to be like an overnight you know, re-education on the function of bare assets, right? Like, this is going to be a challenge. And that's ultimately, right. Yeah, like, this is where the political question comes in, right? I have this, you know, for just to pivot slightly, but it comes back to this question is like, if Bitcoin were to succeed, you know, outside the United States, like at a national level, right? That's like, there's different ways this could go, but I think you got to consider all the different permutations. And like one, I think plausible, I wouldn't put like a high percentage point on it, but like one, I think it's James O'Byrne. Thank you, whoever put that in. Go check out his Twitter feed. I think he just posted it like yesterday or today on that sort of, on that vault proposal. Shifting back to like, if you had a GCC nation decide, we're going to take 5% of our sovereign wealth fund and we're going to put it into Bitcoin and we're going to self-custody it as a sovereign wealth, you know, institution. And maybe, you know, we'll take like, we'll first have like Michael Saylor, we'll have, you know, one of these institutional grade custody providers do it. But eventually, like the whole point is we want to like make it something like gold that's in our own vault. We're going to do it ourselves, et cetera. Those nations start developing their own kind of like sovereign custody solutions that I'm sure like other nations would look to be like, oh, how did you guys do that? Right. And Salvador was, I think, too small to, I think, really move the needle in terms of this global picture. But you can imagine then like a bunch of Middle Eastern sovereigns that have, say, 5% of their sovereign wealth fund in a self-custody Bitcoin solution, that's like an interesting thing, right? But that's a very different dynamic that I think Bitcoiners are comfortable with, because that's like a bunch of just existing elite, you know, not necessarily liberal, you know, people adopting Bitcoin. Like, I'm not sure how we would feel about that, right? If like the people on the vanguard of Bitcoin adoption were a bunch of, you know, Saudi princes and folks in Dubai or in Kuwait with a bunch of oil money and natural gas money that they want to protect from US sanctions. Like, are we good with that? Right? Like, we would have to be comfortable with that being like the vanguard of the adoption, as opposed to, you know, the typical Lebanese person trying to protect their money from the banking system. But this is that's a plausible scenario that could play out. I don't know, Bitcoin is money for enemies. Bitcoin is a global, network. So I think you're going to see it interact with different political systems very differently. I don't think it's gonna be like one nice, simple narrative that you're going to be able to like put it all under. It's going to be just very messy.
I have two questions on my mind, and I'm debating which way do I want to fork this conversation. because I just came up with one when you were just saying your bit. Okay, I'm gonna go in this direction because this is what I wanted to ask you in the very beginning when you were talking about how the government structure isn't necessarily a monolith the way that, and I love how you said it, right? So everyone wants this beautiful story, but it's not, there's a lot more nuance. It's a lot more complex. And I love that. You really opened my eyes on that because I never really looked at it from that perspective. So Matt, do you believe in, and hopefully we have time for the next question, but do you believe the theory in the sovereign individual that basically the information age is going to lead eventually to the death of the nation state, how it's organized today? Do you believe in that theory? Or again, to use your words, or is that just a very simple, you know, way of storytelling basically?
Oof, you're gonna be like the PhD thesis question here. It's like, you know, there's a lot in that question. I'd say the bottom line is I think it's directionally accurate, but I think there's a lot of uncertainty around that directional around that direction. And I think in terms of direction and timescales, because at least like at a structural level, right? Like, usually you see existing institutional framework, especially like what you might call like nation state structure, which is a relatively recent like legal concept. Like, a nation state has existed since like the Peace of Westphalia and then the Concert of Europe. And even then it was kind of like there were hierarchies of nations. There were the great powers and there was kind of colonial possessions. But these are all kind of like, these are narrative fictions, right? These are legal concepts. These are political concepts. These are like, you know, stories people say, like, I'm a part of this government. Well, when materially what you actually look at is you look at how many people exist in which cities and who pays their salaries and what tools do they have? What legal authorities do they have? What weapons do they have? Like, these are the things, like material foundations of these institutional structures. And we have examples of like these breaking in really bad ways, like the, you know, collapse of the Soviet Union and everything that can come out of that, like, just chaotic environment where an existing state structure that sort of erodes from within and that, you know, was managing this large, you know, geographically and culturally, you know, heterogeneous area, it collapses and you get this sort of chaos, right? You get sort of warlordism. And we see that throughout history, right? The rise and fall of sort of central dynasties in China has seen this dynamic play out where you have, you know, a centralized power that grows to some point at which it can't sustain itself. And like any sort of inevitable dynamic where, you know, it reaches a point of, instead of, you know, mutual expansion, like it starts to, you know, waste more resources to try to keep itself from collapsing. And that causes the collapse to go faster, like a star, you know, transmuting elements up the periodic chain to, say, iron, and then it can't get any marginal kind of nuclear energy, and then it's, you know, collapses and you get a supernova, right? I don't know if that's like the inevitable path, right? That's like, you know, that have a cycle that's mostly like political plus economics. There's folks like the South that look at it mostly from this like slightly technological angle. I think predicting the future is impossible, right? I just think there's going to be other things that we don't really know their full effects yet. Like if you took like ChatGPT and you scaled it up by a factor of 100 in 10 years, dude, like what does that mean the means of production? What does it mean for distribution of surplus labor and political reactions against that neo-Ludditism? And like there could be entirely new political and sort of social reactions and counter reactions that could right now don't exist, that could become like the dominant fractures in society in 5 or 10 years. And that's where I think the cyber digital thesis is great. It was like a high level schema that I think was really prescient in a lot of ways. But like, I try not to narrow down like what this, this is the way the world is going to be. And I think like we're hitting a lot of these weird inflection points, whether it's like AI technology, whether it's just like general institutional instability across a lot of dimensions, geopolitical instability. Like, I don't know, it's gonna be a messy decade. I just want to get through it. And I think Bitcoin's like real raison d'etre should be to get through the decade without either precipitating like a massive counter reaction by like the existing institutional framework and then political framework, just like work on itself, right? Go and grind in the gym and get really strong and like, you know, like build up your core, you know, so that you can, you know, like it's like running the marathon this decade, essentially. Because it's gonna be very messy. A lot of stuff could happen. It could be hit, you know, like you're getting whacked from all angles. And I think, you know, if we sort of reach some new equilibrium after a period of disorder and, you know, recalibration, maybe there's like, you know, a quietude and we can like calmly adjust to some new arrangement. I don't know. Like, technology may not let us do that. It might just be like smooth takeoff and then we're in the super AI takeover scenario. We'll see.
So it's, you know, and I really enjoyed this conversation because basically you're very careful not to, you're very careful to emphasize the complexity of a lot of these things and point out, you know, human beings' tendency to storytell and simplify certain highly complex macro issues. And I really enjoyed that. It really opened my eyes today. So you mentioned something in the very beginning, which was the overall macro picture you do agree with in the sovereign individual. And what is that? The macro picture is essentially that information technologies are going to take away a lot of power from the existing nation state models. That you're right, that in the grand scheme of history, they're actually really, really young, right? These aren't very old types of models in the current organization scheme, right? It's just, it just continues to grow and grow and grow. You do believe that the internet, Bitcoin, you know, the free flow of information, do you agree that it's going to affect these nation states' ability to do things the way that they've been used to doing it, right? That, you know, extremely effective taxation, number one, and number two, you know, the ability to print money, basically. You do agree that in the long term, and because of the nature of this technology, you do agree that I would say it's common sense, right?
I mean, I'm hopeful. I guess I have like I'm a realist, and I spend a lot of time thinking about like worst case scenarios, and I also see just like we have examples now of, you know, existing state structures that have effectively captured the internet to wield it as a tool for social surveillance and oppression, namely China. It's not total. There are there are cracks here and there, but it suffices for the ruling elite to basically keep the political system, decently stable. This is a major, I think it's going to be a major trend this decade, is the balkanization of the global internet. And to what extent do, it's really going to come down to this is a larger conversation, but like the trajectory from the open internet being like this open protocol to really being a bunch of like walled gardens, right? Of like oligarchic techno platforms, right? That all kind of arrange with each other and with the state to basically, align with their political benefactor. So like, block. And these are techno governance systems that are competing to sort of pull acquired territories and populations into their block. This is what like the Chinese digital yuan and BRI is all about, is essentially trying to pull in more of the Eurasian free into the Chinese sort of techno block, and they're going to export their surveillance systems and their AI technology and their digital currency platforms and try to get these populations into their sphere of influence that's really going to be like anchored in these hard technical networks. And then they're basically trying to squeeze out the global Facebook network plus the global Swift and Fedwire system plus like the bilateral trade flows that they're trying to, so like this is the problem when you have a geopolitical competition, is that the competition dynamic means that each of those two competing systems like is not going to like Bitcoin too much, right? Because like Bitcoin is the opposite to both of them, right? To a certain extent. I mean, my thesis is that Bitcoin is like much worse for the Chinese version here, and so like we should not try to compete with China on their like just try to replicate what China's doing and try to create like an America version of that, surveillance CBDC system that just has like an American flag on it versus like a Chinese flag on it. But like we should actually have like a techno governance system and a value system that's like aligned to our values that will be more attractive, like just endogenously to the rest of the world.
100%, 100%. But that's not compatible with the, like, for example, Matt, in the digital assets framework, right? The executive order released by the Biden administration, which led to the US Treasury to release a report. In that report, it was called The Future of Money. And that entire report called The Future of Money, they mentioned stable coins, they mentioned payment systems. Bitcoin was, and the future of money, according to them, are central bank digital currencies. And then you think about it, like, why is the future of money? Because with central bank digital currencies, they're able to maintain their privilege, right? So I agree with you. I think Bitcoin is much closer ideals to the founding principles of this country, right? But specifically to the bureaucracy, there they have much closer ideals to the China central bank digital currency.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain people who like surveillance, like folks in you talk to Warren staffers and they just think Bank Secrecy Act and KYC, AML, like these are universal goods. And in fact, we should make the sacrifice between financial privacy, individual autonomy on behalf of national security prerogatives. That these are not interests that we have to like weigh delicately. There's just a clear preference for one value set over another. And I think, there are people who have that value set. I think it's a matter of, that's a matter of political contestation and democratic argument and then representative, engagement in the political system to make those people's preferences not determinative of how national security power is wielded. I think right now, these things change very quickly. So I'm not, everyone focuses on Warren, but like Warren is one person. She's 77. She's not going to be here, right, running the show in 10 years, right? So it's like, okay, like maybe not fixate so much on just that one person. I agree with you. The Treasury Department, the bureaucracy is going to respond to this pressure that they see politically. The bureaucracies do what bureaucracies do, though. Like oftentimes, these people just like, they have a day job, 9 to 5. And, it's like the political, the politicals that run those departments that, are like the head of this big machine. And those people change very frequently, right? Like every administration comes in, you get like a 180 degree shift of how these agencies are oriented towards these things. So this is why I don't think it's as deterministic as this, but that's why I'm engaged in Bitcoin as like a kind of, I like to write about this because that conversation, you can make this argument that like, while maybe like the knee jerk reaction is to sort of try to mimic China, because that's like, you know, like the obvious thing to do. Well, actually, maybe that's like long term, maybe even in the short term, going to be like bad for us. Maybe it's going to cause more cost to us either politically or even just like because of hard power, right? Like even the Fed, you know, Powell said privately that he doesn't really like a CBDC because, you know, it makes him someone that like Congress can like twist more buttons with, right? He wants like no part of this. It's like a major political, like, you know, it's like radioactive to sort of, you know, own that. Cool. Like now he's be like political, essentially. He already is. That would like, yeah, supercharge it.
Yeah.
And there's like a much more complicated monetary question. We, you know, I know we're out of time, but like, that's like the function of the offshore dollar system and exactly how a CBDC like really doesn't really work for that. Like you would have to disintermediate the global banks. And actually Zoltan Poznar has made this point. Like it wouldn't be like a simple technocratic surveillance control apparatus. It would be like, we need to get rid of basically the global monetary hierarchy through existing financial systems. You know, that would really target like a lot of the existing like power structure. Like the JP Morgans would really fight that 100%. So you might see this weird hybrid of like a wholesale CBDC that's just kind of like interbank clearing, and then they whitelist stable coins, and you get, you know, they have to do the same KYC AML, you know, thing. And then it's gonna be on the technocratic margin, the rulemaking and how this works internationally. I don't know. This is yet to be determined. And I think it's still of a, you know, an open aperture to see how it could shake out. And, you know, I don't think it's, individuals have agency. That's like the bottom line. This isn't just like inevitable historical dynamic. You know, these are things that like people can affect.
Yeah. Wow. What a rabbit hole. Matt, I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for joining us today. Why don't you tell everybody what you're working on nowadays and where people can find you online?
So my day job is I'm the director of security intelligence for a geopolitical and cybersecurity advisory firm called the Krebs Stamos Group. So if you're a C-suite executive for a multinational that's confronting geopolitical risk, give me a shout out. I'm also a national security fellow at the Bitcoin Policy Institute, started by David Zell, Grant McCarthy, with a full roster of fellows, Trill, you mentioned, that really are trying to engage in putting out like, you know, good research and analysis on Bitcoin specifically to help shape kind of the larger policy conversation. And I'm on Twitter at Matthew_Pines. I just released a novel about like 3 days ago on AI and quantum computing. So, you know, if you're interested in, you know, sort of espionage, science, thriller stuff, check that out. It's on my pinned tweet. So, yeah.
What's it called?
It's called Expectation Value. So I'm like a full physics nerd. That my undergrad expectation value is like a physics concept. So yeah,
very,
it's a little bit wonky.
Very, very cool. Not wonky at all. I think it's really interesting. Matt, thank you so much for joining us on Simply Bitcoin IRL. I'm going to put you backstage for a second. Guys, hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure to hit that like button. Subscribe if you feel like this conversation provided you value. The normal live show will be back tomorrow at 12:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And of course, shout out to Opti. Thank you so much for producing, like always, my friend. Guys, I'll catch you on the next one.